All right. Session number four, setting the groundwork for food security in Latin America and the Caribbean. It is my pleasure to introduce you to two dear friends and colleagues, people I have met, a couple of years ago, even neighbors, isn't it? We have been in collaboration in different studies, different settings in Latin America and the Caribbean, in Guatemala, in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, in Paraguay, etc. And so it's my pleasure to introduce you to the two colleagues who will co-chair session number four, Humberto Monardes, who is a professor in the Department of Animal Science, McGill University, and Miguel Garcia Winder. He's the representative of the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation in Agriculture in Washington, D.C. Muchísimas gracias por su apoyo, and I wish all of us a great session on Latin America and the Caribbean. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Good late afternoon. We're going to do something interesting for the students here. We're going to improvise co-sharing. You have never seen that before.
That's right.
That's right, isn't it? Yes, you see. We just decided who's going to speak first. Okay. I won. Please adjust your GPS so we are going south of Rio Grande. Latin America and the Caribbean. And I'm very pleased. Thank you for the invitation, Dr. Hugo. Thank you for your nice words. And, I'm very pleased. I'm honored to be able to introduce the speakers. I'll do the first part, and then my colleague will continue during the discussion period. Are you okay with that?
I'm fine.
Thanks. So let me introduce our first speaker. By the way, chairing and introducing speakers, it's not as easy as it appears. It's true. I mean, they give you something to read, and I hate that. So I prefer to ask the speakers, what do you want me to say about you? And normally the reaction is, oh, a couple of lines. Okay. So our first speaker, Professor Ajamada Kushalapa, he said to me, Humberto, just say that I'm associate professor of plant science, McGill University, and a plant pathologist. And I say, no way. I would rather translate that in other things. I'd rather say he's a plant improver. He's all the time looking, discovering genes against biotic stress, you call that. Biotic stress using metabolomics. That's the key word for him, and target and functional genomics. Somebody will have to translate that part. He is the principal investigator, the principal Canadian investigator of an international project on improving food security of indigenous communities in Colombia through potato production and nutrition funded by IDRC. Actually, he's trying to discover genes in potato against late blight, and also functional foods in potato. What can I say about him? He impressed me the most, and he's been our way of communicating, is that he spent several years in the Universidad Federal de Viçosa, Brazil, for 8 years. So we communicate in Portuguese. That has been our link throughout the years. He's a recipient, and this is, we have to recognize this, he's a recipient of Dr. and Mrs. Bailey's Award from the Canadian Phytopathology Pathology Society for an exceptional and distinguished contribution to plant pathology. I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Kushalapa.
Good afternoon. At the outset, I would like to thank the organizing committee for giving me an opportunity to speak to you all. Like Hugo said, if you did not stretch, please look up. You will see them making a global food security logo here. So now you got your neck stretched. So now we can listen. Well, the global food security, the project what we had was with the Colombia, with the Nariño community. These communities all the way in Pasto on the hilltop, they said they were forced to grow drugs. If we have enough money, we will not do that. We are a good community. We want to serve. We want to be good people. Our children are growing up, and if they don't have enough money, we can't control them. So that's a big challenge. You know. So we focused only on a small community, and this project is between McGill and Universidad Nacional de Colombia in Bogota, one of the good universities in Colombia, very well established. So, and also we had other people, third parties, University of New Brunswick, and also SIP, Centro Internacional de Patata, and also Funde Surco, one of the organizations in Colombia. These, we focused mainly on about five localities. Okay. We met with all these indigenous community people, very nice, very humble people. Okay. And first thing they said was, we are very willing to cooperate with you, but we have our own way of life. So we try to understand what their own way of life. Okay. This is what you can do, follow if you wish. Okay. They were polite, we got to be polite. We focused on three major issues. Okay. One is in nutrition and health. Second one is agriculture and gender. And third one is improving Pareto crop. All these farmers have only 3 hectares of 2 to 3 hectares of land, and mainly they grow Pareto. So how to improve these things? So in the left are the Colombian partners, and the right is for three major areas, we have 3 people coordinating these several projects. In the nutrition and health, first of all, not much study was done with this community. So first was to characterize the nutrition and health. Then these people developed a booklet to educate these people. Excellent book. It's a small booklet. And schools were very well established among adult education in those schools, you know. And these books and all these things were very useful in educating these people. When you study the food insecurity, up to 96-97% of the community people are food insecure. The national average is only 42%, whereas food insecurity for the Nariño region is about 68%. Okay. Similarly, the chronic malnutrition is also very high. Okay. These were the baselines. Okay. Now the university developed a booklet, and this booklet was used to educate these schools. There were several schools. Okay. And not only the booklet to educate people, but also they made special foods considering their own indigenous community taste. Okay. And they were used to train about 500 families. The second was the family roles and gender. Family roles in agriculture, family roles in child nutrition, and also women empowerment as a member of the family. So I would like to stress the last one. When we spoke to those people, they do not want women to be empowered on their own. They want women empowerment as part of the family. It's rather a family empowerment, and so they want to grow. Men also came for all these things. They want to grow together and exchange information. Okay. So this this study involved about 433 participants in this study. They visited all these families and inquired, gathered information on several food insecurities. Women, when they were asked, they were mothers, and they care more the husbands and the elders, maybe not much the children. So, but the men mainly made decisions, marketed all the products. The money was with them. A lot of these new people, the youngsters, they want control of the money, they want to education, and they want to involve in several activities. Okay. So they want to play a better role. Above all, they want to go to school and learn. Okay. These are the outcomes of this survey. And all these in about 871 households, we inquired, and there were a lot of statistics on all these things. They were given to the Colombian authorities. Okay. These were the ICBF, the Colombian Institute for Welfare. They were actually very actively involved in all these programs. Ministry of Health and also other local authorities. And the third component we dealt with was the improvement of preto, which is the major staple food of these indigenous communities. In this project, we evaluated about 10 new genotypes in different localities and quantified tuber yield, nutrition content, and processing qualities, and resistance to late blight of preto, one of the devastating diseases of preto. I will talk more on that later. Okay. And the community participation was excellent. Okay. They were very happy to grow. They were grown in the farmers' fields, and they themselves were involved in collecting all the data. And these are the yield data. Some were high yielding, some were low yielding. So we selected the high yielding cultivars. Some had poor processing qualities, and others had better. Selected the combination of these two. Finally, we came up with three new cultivars, and these new cultivars were released to the community. This is the first time they ever used an improved cultivar. Okay. And these cultivars were tested for virus freeness and tissue culture, and then they were seeds were multiplied and given to all the families to grow. Okay. So even the further production is also community-based. This is the overall work we did. We did some genomics work, but it is halfway through. Now, in the 70s, there was Green Revolution. In the Green Revolution, there was a lot of food, but at the cost of high fertilizer and high pesticide. Companies became very rich. Poor could not use much of these. They don't have money to buy all these things. Maybe this is the time for gene revolution. How can the gene revolutionize all the food? Okay. It is possible. It is out there in different varieties. We planted about 100 cultivars, genotypes, in one of the hilly areas where late blight of Pareto was severe. Most of them were dead without fungicides. People apply 15 applications every week. They apply fungicides. Even in Canada, after 150 years of Irish famine due to late blight of Pareto, still we apply every week fungicides. Okay. Now, if you look at the resistance, on the left side, the stems are resistant, and leaves are dead. On the right side, you see there is a lot of those. In our lab, we applied forward and reverse genetics to identify the metabolites or the chemical compounds the plant produces and the genes. Then we silence the genes and prove the resistance. What happened in a simple word, this is the metabolic pathway, all the way down, whatever the photosynthesis, plant produces lignin. When the pathogen comes, it produces the intermediate and deposits around the cell wall to make the cell thick. On the left is the thick cell wall and the right is the thin. There are so many other compounds. For each compound, there is a gene. We can introduce these genes into these and make it resistant to multiple diseases and pests. Now there is a new technology. We don't have to introduce the bacterial gene. It's a the GMO, genetically modified food. Same technology we can introduce to transfer gene from one plant to another plant. That will be the future. And that's called cisgenic. That's what, and this technology can be used to increase yield, nutritional quality, biotic stress, and abiotic stress. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, dear Kusha.
No red card.
No. We didn't reach that point. Let me introduce our second speaker. He's around. Professor Leroy Philip is a retired associate professor at McGill University. I asked him the same question, what do you want me to say about you? I said, sure, tell me what you want to say. You won't dare to say it. I'm here to show him that I'm there to say this. He said, I'm transplanted Kitishan. It means he's from St. Kitts. Transplanted Kitishan, living in Montreal, working today for peanuts. I remind you that he's working at home now because he's retired. But in fact, he received his BSc degree in animal science from McGill, PhD in rumen and nutrition from Guelph University, 28 years of experience in academia, work experience in industry, and has established national and international research collaboration to improve animal production and food and nutrition security. He is co-principal investigator of a 5 million food security project sponsored by the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund that links small farmers to school feeding programs to improve child nutrition and agricultural productivity in the Caribbean. I'm very pleased to receive him.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Umberto. That was a rather kind introduction by Umberto. I was quite worried he might tell you the truth about me, but he respected our friendship. Let me begin by indicating to you that this project, which deals with food security, it deals with work that we conduct in the Caribbean in collaboration with the University of West Indies. And I would like to begin by acknowledging the large number of people and institutions that made it possible for me to speak to you today. It's a very large project, number of researchers, number of institutions, but I would say to you it was probably one of the most fascinating experience of my entire career, because we had to deal with about 75 people on a daily basis, many, many institutions, but at the end it was worth every minute of the day. We are talking about a region of the world, the Caribbean, which when one discusses food security or food insecurity, this region is not really known to be food insecure in the traditional sense of stunting and undernutrition. The real issue with this region of the world with regard to food security has to do with obesity, caloric overnutrition, especially among women, and increasingly among children. And what is characterizing this problem is a relatively low intake of vegetables and fruits, low levels of activity, and in particular, an inability of the population to receive rather readily a diverse diet rich in vegetables and fruits. And as a consequence of this scenario, what we are finding in the Caribbean, what we call the CARICOM countries. It's an amalgamation of 15 countries in the Caribbean joined together through a common colonial legacy, is we have seen a rather rapid and steady increase in the level of food imports and a virtual stagnant of decrease in exports. So there's this huge imbalance in trade that exists in the Caribbean to the extent that there's a food import bill of about $4 billion per year. This table shows on the far right, the last column, the extent of the problem, so that if you look at the caloric intake of the populations, it's about 17-20% in excess of what is required. If you look at the vegetables and fruits intake, it's about 40% less than what would be the recommendation. So that is the challenge that we are facing in the Caribbean at the moment. What we attempted to do in this particular project is to take an approach to address childhood obesity and overweight that would involve school feeding. We wanted to use the school feeding programs in the region to bring about a change in the nutrition outcome of children and to link the school feeding program with smallholder farmers and to engage institutions in bringing about a kind of change that we want to effect. We had, of course, very generous resources from the CIFSERF program. We had very little time, and so we had to mount a tremendous effort in order to bring about the kind of change that we wanted. And we couldn't do that at all without tremendous contribution from our partners. But our principal idea was to link the sectors of agriculture and education and health, because we see this problem of obesity as being multisectoral. And what is really engaging us is the very, very difficult challenge that the region is facing with regard to non-communicable diseases, including diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular diseases. And these diseases are now regarded as being the highest, contributing the highest among the Americas to the death toll in the Caribbean, in that region of the world. So our goals overall, which I've truncated here just to give you a bit of an idea, our real goal was to try to intervene to change the dietary offerings in the school feeding programs to improve nutrition outcome of the children, and to equip smallholder farmers with technologies so that they would be able to supply the school feeding programs with the necessary vegetables and fruits to bring about the change that we wanted to bring about. The entire project had very, very broad scope. We undertook studies in four different countries in the CARICOM region. We had a range of interventions that dealt with social science, interventions that dealt with nutrition science, interventions that dealt with agricultural production. But what I'm going to do within the next 5 or 6 minutes that I have is to concentrate on what we did in this island of St. Kitts, where most of the interventions were taking place, in order to give a sense of the integrated approach that we adopted in order to make a change with regard to nutrition outcomes of the children. The school lunch intervention was rather simple. What we did is we went into these schools. We had 7 schools under investigation, 3 schools control and 4 schools under test. And we simply changed the menus such that we had very generous offerings of vegetables and fruits as a new menu, as opposed to the old menu, which had virtually no vegetables and fruits. What this is showing is what change took place over the time course of this study. We began this study around January 2012, and what you're seeing is the kilograms of produce, vegetables and fruits, that were delivered to the school feeding program at the start. And the first bar clearly shows that at the very beginning, virtually no vegetables and fruits were served to the children. when we estimate it was about less than 10% of the offerings. And as time went on with our intervention, we end up having very substantial contribution to the school meals program. In fact, if we were to add the cumulative amounts, we ended up with about 20 tons of fresh produce delivered to the school feeding program. This slide shows the diversity of the produce that we ended up supplying to the school meals, beginning with about 5 to 6 different kinds of vegetables and fruits, and ending up towards the end of the project with about 13 or 14 different produce. So we really had a very great impact in both the quantity and the diversity of produce delivered to the school meals. I'll show you now what the responses were very quickly. On the right-hand side, you're seeing the response in the consumption of vegetables and fruits by the children in Saint Kitts Nevis, that's the official name of the country. And what you're seeing is a sort of a doubling of the servings, moving from 0.3, well, 0.3 of us, the Canadian food guide recommends 5 servings of vegetables and fruits per day. And what you can see, so 0.3 of a serving is virtually nothing. But 0.3 going to 0.6, I mean, it's a doubling. But it just shows you how far we have to go to get vegetables and fruits into the children. Now, remember, that's a lunch, so it's about 1/3 of the daily supply. But we were able to improve the offering and the consumption of vegetables and fruits by the children. In Trinidad, I'm just showing you what happened in Trinidad, because in Trinidad, we also did a similar type of study. So in both cases, we were able to increase the amounts. Here, I'm showing you the data with regard to obesity and overweight estimates. At baseline, if we look at all groups simply mean combining the control group and the treatment group. At baseline, the proportion of kids who were both overweight and obese, we combine those two, is about 20%. Now, if you partition that into control and treatment, we have a little difference between those two groups. But if we now look at what happened between endpoint and baseline, what you're seeing is in the control group, we have about a 6.7% change. In the treatment group, about a 6.3% change, unit change. So there's no real difference between the treatment and the control with regard to the impact on obesity and overweight. That, of course, was disappointing because that's what we wanted to find. But, of course, in an experimentation, you don't get always what you want to get. So that was the observation. What we think is more important for you to observe is the fact that over time, nevertheless, there was an increase in obesity prevalence and overweight. So irrespective of the treatment, the kids are still getting overweight with time. So that is signaling to the policymakers that there's a serious issue to be dealt with regard to childhood obesity. I'm going to go through rather quickly now what happened with regard to agricultural production, because the only reason we were able to get these vegetables and fruits into the school meals is because of what we did at the farm level. We introduced at the farm level drip irrigation technologies under the leadership of Chandra Majumuru, and I'll show you very briefly what we observed. We investigated about 10 different vegetables and fruits, pumpkins, string beans, and some of these were never grown before. And in virtually every case, you can see using, if you look at the red bars, which represents not irrigated, as opposed to the blue bars, which indicate irrigated, we are getting some very substantial improvements in productivity of crops as a consequence of irrigated treatment. So we are improving the productivity of the crops, and we're improving the diversity of the crops. One of the things that Chandra also did was used what is called a computer simulation model to estimate the water deficit. So for the first time, we were able to evaluate what is the crop water requirements on these farms. And therefore, farmers are now able to drip irrigate the crops precisely to the water needs. And we were able to calculate a 20% improvement in water use efficiency. Umbeda, is my time up? 2 minutes. 2 minutes means I'll go through 2 slides. We also characterize post-harvest losses. We have heard over the past few hours. Post-harvest losses, we characterize post-harvest losses using string beans and tomato. And what I can tell you, post-harvest losses amount to as much as 70% if you go from the farm up to the plate. So even though we are getting productivity improvements, we are still losing quality as a consequence of post-harvest treatments. The last area that we investigated was technology adoption. The middle row, the middle column of this table shows the extent to which irrigation as a technology is adopted. And we are indicating here that the level of technology adoption among these farmers is quite low. Whether we talk about St. Kitts, Trinidad, or Guyana, in general, technology adoption is low. Record keeping is actually disappointingly poor. And so what we wanted to do is to find out what are the constraints to technology adoption. And Alex Senville and her supervisor, Gordon Hickey, did some very innovative work on social capital among farmers. And the short story is this. When you go into these communities, what you would find is that the knowledge flows among the community farmers within this community varies very much depending on the kind of ties and relationships that have been cultivated. So what we are learning now, if we want to get farmers adopting technology, we have to understand what kind of a social learning mechanism exists and then exploit that social learning mechanism to be able to make an impact on their technology adoption attitudes. Finally, what we were able to accomplish through this project is a model for food security that includes multifaceted aspects. So we have food school feeding, which is one pillar of our model. We have agricultural technologies resulting in production and use of local fruits and vegetables, and we have developed mechanisms for procurement of that produce from the farmers. We now understand a little bit more about the psychology and the sociology of farmers' practices. So we are now delivering to the CARICOM policymakers an approach towards solving these problems that we believe is multifaceted, and we are hoping that this would result in a new approach to problem solving with regard to food security. Here is a lady, Itina, that we always like to speak about. I asked her during the end of the project whether or not she was making any more money now than she was making before the project. And rather than answer me the question, she gave me a very nice smile, and I therefore didn't want to ask anymore. So I want to indicate to you that it seems to me that we have had quite a positive impact. This slide simply shows the extent to which we reached farmers. We had about 2,000 or so souls that we impacted. And I think Rena would agree with me, if IDRC is asking the question, was the money spent well, he would have no difficulty justifying the grant to his, I was going to say superiors, but you're a superior person, Rena. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lira. Thank you very much. Let me call our third speaker. Jaime Luis Carrera, ¿dónde estás? Jaime, I asked Jaime also, what do you want me to say about you? He said, Humberto, speak about my passions. So, oh my goodness, I cannot say that. Well, maybe I can. Jaime's passions are basketball and food security, of course. Soccer and food security. His family and food security, and the Barcelona soccer club,
and food security,
of course. But honestly, Jaime is an experienced researcher on subjects related to agriculture, natural resources, and environment, particularly from an economic perspective. In the last 10 years, he has been involved in development and consolidation of the system of environmental and economic accounting for Guatemala, rural development analysis, and food security studies. He's a senior researcher at IARNA, the Institute of Agriculture, Agricultura, Recursos Naturales y Ambiente, at the Rafael Landívar University in Guatemala. Presently, he's leading the project Food Security and Undernourishment in Guatemala, This is a collaborative project between YARNA, McGill University, and IICA, which I'm happy, lucky to be involved to, funded by the IDRC. You seem so such a modern and powerful technology. He's going to talk about that. As a consultant, he has worked for public institutions as the National Bank, universities, public agencies, FAO, IDB, USAID, CEPAL, and different NGOs. Let's welcome Jaime.
Good afternoon. Yes, when I met for the first time Professor Hugo Monardes, I thought it is going to be difficult to work with this guy. And after almost 2 years, I'm thinking exactly the same. Because he has always good words about the people he knows, and it's always difficult to reach the people he tells the others we are. So I'm very glad to work with him in that project, and I'm going to try to say and to tell you the basics of the project and some of the results we have right now. Yeah. The project name, the formal name is Efficacy of Practices and Policies to Improve Food Security and Nutrition in Guatemala. I'm going to try to say something about the synergies between research and policy advocacy to improve food security and nutrition based on the work we are doing in Guatemala. Rapidly, the outline, I'm going to say something about the undernourishment in the world in Guatemala in order to highlight why to work in Guatemala. Briefly, some things about the project, and then some results, and what are we doing now. Yeah, the 90% of children with chronic undernourishment live in 34 countries. These countries are concentrated in Africa, in India, and there is only one country in America that is Guatemala. When we saw some analysis taking different countries, multinational analysis, that makes some comparisons between GDP per capita and the stunting prevalence in preschoolers, we can see that Guatemala is not going with the trend. We have a relative high GDP per capita, but our indicators of chronic undernourishment are very, very bad. Guatemala is within the 36 high burden countries for stunting. One of each two children is stunted. However, important investments on food security and nutrition have been made during the last 2 years, two decades. And then we are trying to know why these policies and these interventions haven't been so effective for the country. So I have to say about the project, we are focused on smallholder farmers because the 80% of food insecurity families are related to agriculture in the rural areas. 70% of these people is indigenous. We are doing this work in four different territories of Guatemala. We selected 10 locations in these four different territories. Even if Guatemala is a very small country, there is a huge diversity. We have 23 different Mayan languages or indigenous languages. We have 14 different ecological zones. So we can find a lot of diversity. So we are trying to know how that diversity has something to do with the effectiveness of these policies. 8 of these locations have been prioritized by the biggest food and security and nutrition program, national program. So it's also interest to know how this program is working in these locations. So there is two main components in the project. The first one is a research component. I'm going to talk about this the next minutes. And the other one is a policy advocacy component where we are trying to, we will be trying to have some impact on the policy, on the policy design and implementation. But the research component seeks basically to three things. Firstly, we are going to, we have characterized smallholders farmers. Then we are trying to model the food system dynamics of these families. We are trying to understand how this this dynamics is different between the different locations in order to evaluate food and security policies and practices. Some results. I'm going to talk now about the characterization of farmers. We did a survey in the 10 locations. Basically, we have collected information about housing conditions, agricultural production, income, natural resources use, participation on capacity building programs. We take anthropometric data. We have also food consumption, food expenditures, among others. What can we see? I think it's there is enough evidence about the difference between the four territories. This is the percentage of families having tap water access, a basic service. We can see, for example, for the territory four, that almost the 70 to 80% of families have access of water by tap in their homes. And the territory two and three is less than 50%, for example. There is also a very interesting results showing by this graph. This was a question that we made about the willingness of the families to shift from food production to market-oriented production. Sorry. At what we found is that in many of the locations, there are at least 70% of families that are not willing to produce for market, but they want to continue to produce their own food. And this was also something surprising for us, because we know that there has been a lot of work during the last years in Guatemala. This is a question we made to the families about the participation on child care capacity building programs. We were asking if at least one of the members had participated in such a program. And we found in at least 8 locations that the participation was below the 10% of families. And very rapidly, these are the results we had for the anthropometric measures for stunting. In 7 of the 10 locations we are working on, we found stunting above 50% of prevalence. I'm going to shift to the second objective of the research component, that is the modelation of the dynamics of food security. Firstly, we decide to work with a participatory approach. So the first step was to identify and to select stakeholders that were working at the local level. We were basically working with staff of extension staff of public institutions, like the Ministry of Agriculture, like the Secretary of Food and Security and Nutrition. We were working with a group of women groups, with cooperative of farmers, with municipalities. And the idea was to try to see how was the dynamics, as I said, of the food insecurity. When we selected the relevant stakeholders, we make individual interviews to try to capture their own view of the problem, their own perception of the problems. These people is people that knows not only one or two cases of undernourishment on the territory, but they know a big part of the families that have the problem. And we elaborated something we call causal loop diagrams. It's the field with the papers of different colors. Here we have the causes the stakeholders are saying to us that are very important to the problem, but also the effects that they are recognizing in the territory. And we also have all the feedbacks or the relationships between the effects and the causes. Then we have a more technical work is to write all these mental maps in a software program in order to integrate all the view of the stakeholders. We have then to validate some the final model for the locations, and we order all this information in sub-models. Why are these models important? Well, firstly, they allow us to identify important variables for these locations. Also, we can identify the relationships between these variables, and then to identify these feedbacks that are important also to understand why some policies are not working. And also, they help us to identify and order potential effective policies. And then, with some simulations, we are going to be able to test the effectiveness of the different policy actions. So we have now 10 different models for each of the locations we are working that are part of the project. These models are integrated in territorial models. So we have four territorial models, and then we can have also a national model where all the possible variables that affect the problem may be seen. So I'm going to the last part. This is very rapidly a part of one of the models. I'm not going to enter to explain it, but the idea is that we can see all the different variables, the relationships, and we can find a lot of things we were not thinking about when we were thinking on policies on food security. Something about the policies, the different models, as I said, allows us to think about which policies can be efficient in each of the territories. I have listed here some of the policies we have found, and we have some classification of the potential effectiveness of these policies. For example, Territory 1 is a territory where farmers have little access to land, but also they have little technical assistance. They have very little yields. Here, agricultural productivity policies may be very, very important. But, for example, in Territory 2, they are not so important because the access is better to land. Land and soils are better. There is access to water also, so we can have some difference, and you can see, because of time, all these differences in that chart. Maybe two words about it. We found an important variable and policy in woman empowerment, we found out that some of the problems are related especially to gender issues. Women are very willing to participate in capacity building programs, but then they have to try to lead with the idea of the men on how to implement what they are learning. What for? Right now we are finishing the quantification of the models. We are putting numbers to all these variables and to all these relations in order to be able to simulate and to be able to tell how much each of these policies could improve the performance of the policies. Yeah. In order to identify effective policies for different territories, identify the scalability of the policy interventions, to be able to say, well, in this territory we should, because we have budget constraints, because we have these particular problems, we should do that, and to recommend policy interventions, that is the second component of the research project, to do policy advocacy. And then for the institution, for the university, is also very important because this particular research is giving to us important inputs to all the advocacy policy program of the university. The university has selected 5 topics, very important national topics. We have to research, to do research, and we have to have some proposals. One of these topics is food security. And it's allowing also to do different research. There are other institutes that are taking these results to try to do research from more anthropological approaches, sociological approaches, etc. Thank you.
Thank you, Jaime. A lesson, a recommendation to my students when you are co-chairs, never look at the organizers. They give you an evil eye, you know, when you're controlling the time. Okay, I'm going to let my colleague, Miguel, pardon, to lead the... Somebody calling me? Gracias. To lead the rest of the session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Humberto, I invite the 3 presenters to come and join us. My name is Miguel Garcia Winder, and by my accent, you probably guess I learned it in West Virginia and perfectioned it in Miami, where I spent 10 years working on agribusiness and rural development. With the permission of our chair and the organizers, I just want to make a reflection why Latin America. This is the first time in what is called a global discussion that we have one session about Latin America and the Caribbean. Latin America and the Caribbean in all these discussions appear to be the invisible region of the world. It appears that Latin America doesn't exist except when you go to Cancun, Brazil, Buenos Aires, and that type of things, but not we have problems. But I just want to take a few minutes to say why this is important. Last year, a group of companies and institutions that work together in what is called the Global Harvest Initiative sponsored a story and published a story together with the Inter-American Development Bank, our organization, John Deere, and several other companies about the food security. And they focus on Latin America, and they call Latin America and the Caribbean the future basket of the world. And they said that in the short term and in the medium term, the only region that is able to produce and keep with the demand of food that demographic conditions, social conditions are creating around the world is Latin America. And there are 4 reasons why this is possible. First, we had about 40%, and when I say we, I'm part of Latin America, We have Latin America and the Caribbean, over 40% of the freshwater resources of the world. 40% are in Latin America. Secondly, we have about 30% of the arable land in Latin America. Certainly Africa has a lot of land, no Southeast Asia. We are the most diverse region in the world. As a region, we're considered from the Mesoamerica all to the Patagonia, including to the Caribbean. So we had a tremendous capital of unexploited genes that will be useful for adaptation and mitigation for the future. And then we have something. We have good human capital. Latin America has been investing in human capital for probably close to 40 years. So it's important to look at Latin America and the Caribbean if we want to have a complete picture of food security in the world. We have made tremendous progress. If we look at the reports, some of the countries with the greatest progress on the Millennium Development Goal are Latin American countries and the Caribbean countries. It's not perfect. We have some countries that have not been able to do that, but Chile, Colombia, Peru, Mexico, Trinidad, Jamaica, just on the top of my head, they really are very close, or they have met and surpassed their commitments on the development goal. There's still a lot to do. During the last 20 years, Latin America has become really stable democracies. We have democratic institutions. We have political stability. And we have become very productive. Our yields and our uses have increased. But not everything is good. We have challenges for the future. And the challenges for the future, the first one in terms of productivity, is to have a sustainable intensification of agricultural production. And we need to find new ways to look at the food systems, not only production, but the food systems, from how the food is produced to how the food is consumed. And unless we do that, we will not meet the challenges of the future. Also, we have a big challenge, the challenge of reducing asymmetries and inequalities. It is sad that despite the fact that we have one of the biggest progress in the world, we still have the biggest inequality in the world. The difference between the richest and the poorest in the region is the biggest one in the world, more than in any country. So we have a big challenge. If we don't close that gap, all the progress that we have done in the past is going to go to drain. A good friend of mine likes to say that during the last 20 years, we have created a middle class that we have invited to the party. We have told them how to dress, we opened the door to them, but once they go to the party, they cannot go to the floor dance, much less buy a beer and wine. So our middle class needs to continue to grow in order to enjoy all this. We also have a diverse gap between our countries. A professor has indicated we have net food importer countries, which spend big majority of their income in maintaining food, and we have net exporting countries. We have the challenge to become a green economy. And also, we have the challenge to deal with what I personally call the perverse agenda of the region, and that has to do with drug production, drug trafficking, human trafficking, and basically all the violence. So unless we address those things that at the end affect the way we live and interact, and such it affect the way we make our lives, Latin America will probably not meet, and the Caribbean, when I say Latin America, I won't say lack, Latin America and the Caribbean will probably not meet the challenges of the future. So we need to continue to invest in infrastructure. I think there is a poker of eyes, no aces, eyes. Infrastructure, innovations, investment, and institutions. And that's our challenge. We need to continue to invest to improve our infrastructure, to improve our institutions, the functioning of our institutions, to create innovations, and to attract investment. So I invite you, all of you present here, you allow me, Hugo, to continue to work with Latin America. But I invite you to look at Latin America in a different way. Not Latin America with a new paradigm. Latin America wants to work together. Latin America doesn't require aid. And in order to do that, we have to do it as a partners. And since I am a member of the oldest institution in agricultural development, probably in the world, certainly is in Latin America, we are 73-year-old institute, I invite you to reach to our Inter-American Institute of Cooperation in Agriculture, OAICA, and Dr. Aurea Barnett is here with us. He's our representative in Canada, so I really would expect for you to go and crowd her with potential projects. We have offices in all the countries, and in all honesty, the only concern that we have is the welfare of our region and the world. With this, Hugo, I open the questions to anyone except for me. Thank you. So you have any questions? Questions, Spanish, French, or Portuguese are welcome. No, just kidding, English. Please.
When trying to feed school children in the Caribbean, what were the biggest challenges or inhibitions towards, I mean, was it the children themselves who didn't want to eat healthier food? I mean, what were you up against, I guess? Or was it more of, there was more of a tendency to eat fruits and vegetables and healthier foods, but where does the resistance come from still?
One of the things that we did was to get some indication of the children's preferences. And so we monitored that, and as you could imagine, they didn't like the vegetables. Carrots, they didn't like carrots. They loved watermelon. String beans were in the middle, but we didn't have a high level of resistance, because what we had done is we had worked very carefully with the teachers prior to and coached the teachers, so we didn't have a lot of resistance. But as we expected, the acceptance to what we were doing varied according to the kind of produce that we wanted to introduce. We also had some resistance to the school meals preparation staff, because one of the things we wanted to do was to eliminate the use of sugar. Sugar in the Caribbean is a very popular item, and during the school and school feeding, sugary drinks was something we wanted to do. So that was another area of resistance, cut the sugar out. And the last area of resistance that we had was the sale of candies and other condiments around the schools. But these are not insurmountable problems. We think as we go along, we should be able to capitalize on what we did. And hopefully the level of acceptance would approach what the kids love for watermelon.
Dr. Maga.
Thank you. Have had the opportunity and the honor to learn about the three projects during my time at McGill. I was a Guatemalan myself, able to join the team for the Guatemalan project that was presented through invitations by Professor Cuchalapa and other collaborations in Colombia. I learned about what is going on in Colombia. And some work in the Caribbean, especially in the Spanish-speaking Francophone Caribbean, and just a tiny bit in the English-speaking Caribbean, show me that the region has advanced for the last 10 to 20 years, as Miguel pointed out, in many different areas. And one of those areas is the design of policies and the legislation around food security and nutrition. For that matter, we have in most of the countries in the region, if not in all of the countries, secretariats for councils for food security and nutrition. There is legislation, et cetera, laws that were passed by Congresses and Senates and so on. But still, we are talking about impacting policy, making policy happen, be designed to meet the challenges that the three of you and your colleagues have identified and met, and at the same time addressed with your projects. From your perspective, based on your own experience, what is the most difficult, what is the most challenging issue when trying to communicate with decision makers or with politicians on these topics?
I think you have it easy, guys.
Okay. You can start with those talks, then you can continue.
You go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. You go last.
Yeah, one of the major challenges we found was, you know, like ICA people have the experience. People don't want much money, okay, aid, but they want to develop that institutions to help poor people. Okay, this is one of the most important thing. And the government, we met with higher officials of several institutions, and they were all very, very willing to, you know, collaborate with us, but they do not have tools. It is the university has to come up with the tools. Okay, these are the things you go to increase the food security or improve them, especially the very, very poor people, the Narino people, where they had only 1 to 3 hectares of land, and how to improve them, what to give them. The government has completely ignored them. Okay, so now if university can come up with something, and for that you need fund, and university says we don't get funds. So this is what the local people, the within the country, they have to deal. They have money, but they have to channelize to these things. Thank you.
Dr. Carrera, Professor Philippe, you care to add something else?
Yeah, I think in the case of Guatemala, it's very evident and obvious that there are very basic problems, national problems. For example, the 30% of people above 15 years don't read. If you go to the farmers, our data says that in the case of smallholder farmers, this number is about 70%. So we have basic problems. It's the same, for example, for as phenomena like migration. The models are showing us that these families that have persons that are migrating because they need to work in other parts of Guatemala or in other countries, they might solve the problem of the income, but there are other variables related that create other problems. Yeah, for example, we have found some correlation between migration in families and the age of the first birth in that family for women. For example, so there are solutions or strategies for the families that they might have some impact in the system, but they are creating other problems. So I think one of the things that we should see when we are talking about policy interventions is that historically in Guatemala they are designed only because without sufficient information. Yeah. So I think that we are making some important steps to understand the problem in all its complexity, and then we hope to find strong institutions, we are not sure they are, that might implement it, and they can implement it, the recommendations that are going to be part of the study. I would say at some things, one last thing. We have found also that the main public interventions in Guatemala are highly polarized. I don't know if that's the word in English, but they respond to a party's interest. Yeah. So the farmers or the families that are being prioritized by this policy and these programs are not the really the families that really need this kind of interventions. So this is a problem you have to face, and we know that it's something we can face if the country decide to work in a more equitable society and try to make some more justice just country.
Gracias, professor.
When we began this project, I tell a joke with Ueno because as an academic, when we undertake projects, one of the first things that come to our mind is we don't have enough funds. And so going back to the question of challenge, this is perhaps one of the first projects that I've ever been involved with in which funds, financial resources, was not an issue. So going back to the issue of challenge, because from the vantage point of the Caribbean, one can always argue, make the point, but perhaps the challenge has to do with money. This was clearly not the case. And so in response to the question that was asked, what's the major challenge? I believe that the challenge from my perspective that we encountered, there were three of them. And I call them the three C's. One was commitment. The second was communication, and the third was coordination. And I think if we were able in any project to get around those three C's, we will make a lot of progress. And in the region of the Caribbean, if we set about the business of seeking champions, and I really mean that, champions who have these three C's embedded in their mind, I think we'll make a lot of progress.
Please. And I will refrain to respond myself.
My question is for Dr. Carrera. First of all, thanks so much for coming such a long way. I find the presentation really stimulating. I found especially interesting the numbers you showed on farmers' attitudes towards participating in markets. And I also found it interesting how even in regions that were closer to urban centers or closer to major roadways, there was still a lot of reticence to get involved in producing for export, producing for sale. And I was wondering, in your opinion, what are the reasons for that reticence to get involved?
Yes. When we design the project, we decide to prioritize or to select some locations based on the performance on in four variables. Income was one, expenditure, the other one, two economic variables. One more social is a Gini index of income distribution, and one of food security that was a chronic undernourishment. So we have selected locations where the four variables have improved during the last decade, or locations where they worsen. So we have like two kinds of locations, and we have found that where there were the improvements, farmers are less willing to participate in market-based agriculture production. So they want to continue to produce food. In the others, in the other locations where they have worsened, we think that they are looking, they are more willing to participate in that kind of projects. And we think that they are looking that as a strategy or like as a way to ensure some income. So we think it's because of this characterization of the locations. Yeah, it looks that there is a correlation between these decisions and the way the location has performed during the last years. Yeah.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, my question is directed at Dr. Kushalappa regarding the development of new potato varieties using systemic or transgenic techniques. Given the fact that Peru currently has a moratorium on any GMO potato varieties, citing wanting to protect inherent biodiversity as well as resistance from indigenous peoples, I was wondering whether you are encountering some of the same resistance in Colombia, either from institutions or from grassroots groups, or whether Colombia is a much more accepting environment for this kind of research.
Well, I agree with you. There is a, even in Colombia, it is considered as a center for biodiversity to grow all the diploid potatoes. Similarly, there are so many other things. Okay, now we have improved these varieties based on conventional breeding. What I presented here is a replacement of conventional breeding. It is not, you know, it is a genetic engineering protocol to cut and paste genes. These cultivars, okay, now we release three cultivars. They are moderately resistant to late blighter Pareto. After 10 years of testing, and with the $1 million testing in all the provinces and all the things, still they are only moderately resistant. And they are not better than so many others. So now what we can do is people can develop different cultivars for different nutritional and other things, but they always lack some pest resistance. Now, we can identify these genes, and then potato easy to tissue culture. We cut and paste one gene. We replace the susceptible gene and paste the resistant gene. This would increase genetic diversity. There are two issues here. One is crop diversity. You grow different crops. I'm not against that. When Monsanto and all these things introduced the GMO, they kept all the technology to themselves. Now they made money selling only the BT cotton, BT brinjal, and BT potato and all. Whereas here, all the undergraduate students can pick up this technology once it is standardized. There will be hundreds of people, okay? Even in Canada, if you take potato, there are more than 100 varieties of potato. They breed another one, combining these things. Nothing is improved. Okay. One has ABC, other one has DEF. So now it is possible to take 100 of these varieties to introduce some genes. Another example is, I was talking to Reno. In Canada, in North America, Russet Burbank potato is grown in 60% of the land area, both in US and Canada. All of them apply 15 applications of fungicide. Now we have identified these genes. If somebody gives me money, I would cut and paste some of these genes. Now, Russet Burbank potato, they grow anyway. They apply fungicides. Chemical companies say, when I was a graduate student like you, chemical companies said, okay, no problem. Don't breed for a disease. We are here, chemical company, we'll take care of it. But today, we can reduce that 15 applications of fungicides to 2 or 3. So this is the approach. A lot of people think it is a GMO. It's a big challenge for us to convince people it's not, it's a genetic engineering, all right, but not foreign genes, not transgenic. Trans means foreign genes, and cis means internal, like breeding. Hope I answered your question.
Thank you. Professor?
Tim Johns from McGill. My question in the first instance is to Dr. Carrera, but in reflecting on the three presentations and the comments of Miguel, in Latin America, it certainly has high amounts of biodiversity, but Latin America is a country that has big challenges in terms of environmental challenges, in terms of loss of biodiversity, which is not unique to Latin America, but is certainly the part of our global crisis. And certainly, Jaime, you did talk about natural resources and access to natural resources as part of your discussion, and your models were complex, and so I don't know where they come in. But in terms of what I heard you say, you only talked about water and you talked about land. But if you look at natural resources and environments in relation to ecosystem services and more complex things, I don't see much discussion of environment. I don't see much discussion of landscapes, which to me is in terms of we're looking for sustainable productivity over time, need to be more focused on humans within landscapes. So perhaps you can enlighten us more of where your models, where these kind of things fit within your models.
So we have, in the models, we have seen that there are at least four ways families have access to food. The first one is because they produce food. Second one is because they buy food. The third one is because they collect food from natural forests. And the fourth one is because they participate in different programs of food distribution. Yeah, we have seen also important difference in the relationship in the different territories with the forest as a source of medicine, I would say. In some of the territories, as a mean, the families collect 5 or 6 times medical plants in forests in 3 months, according to our data. In others, they only collect 1 or 2. There are different relationships we are finding in the models and also in the data we collected in the household survey that are also giving us some ideas of the relationships with natural resources. Then we have some territories where there is problems of soil degradation. Deforestation also appears in the models, in the qualitative models, at least in two territories. We have also variables related to the pollution of water as a problem. And I would say that we have some key variables related to environmental issues.
I think we have time for one more question, please.
Thank you very much. Marilyn Scott, McGill University. Leroy, the question is directed to you, sort of. It's actually a broader question, but one of the comments you made me think about this. And you said that in the context of the project in the CARICOM region, cash was not an issue, as in cash for the project. But you raised commitment, communication, and I can't remember the third C.
Coordination, I said.
Coordination. And it made me wonder, in the context of very large amounts of funding that are becoming available for those that are fortunate enough to get those large-scale projects, whether we are training our students, our research community, to be able to manage and work in those very, very large-scale projects. And so it's a really broad question, I think probably applicable to a lot of what we've heard today. But I wondered if you could comment about whether there are things that you think we should be doing more of as we're training young researchers in this kind of a funding climate.
Marina, if I were to begin again, I would probably take about 3 or 4 courses in social science and psychology. because I think especially from my vantage point, it's really about people. And so if as we train, and I go back, as we train our students, I think we train our students to be technologists, right? Good scientists. But I think what we should be doing is to train our students more to be thinking in a multidisciplinary way with behavioral science and social science playing a much stronger role than it is currently playing. Because if, for instance, let's imagine we have data collected, the classic, we have data collected, and we want to be able to deliver, we want to convince someone that our story is solid. If we can't communicate that message effectively, we haven't done our job. And so the whole idea of whatever mechanism we use, the whole idea of communication, and then if I want you to be able to do something for me, I have to be able to communicate to you, I have to be able to trust you. So there's an area here of what I call soft science, soft science, that has some merit. And if I were to begin again, I would be a soft scientist. So that's my point. It's not about money. I mean, you know, it's about softness.
Thank you very much. Maybe this can be a topic for the following symposium. How do we train the future generation of scientists in this field, which obviously represents a new paradigm? And I think some of the questions regarding the policy, regarding the green issues, the biodiversity, probably provide for other 2 or 3 hours. So hopefully the refreshments and the cocktail is long enough so we can discuss all this for the entire night. Otherwise, I also want to finish on time, and this is a demonstration that Latin America has really progressed. We finish on time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Muito obrigado y muchas gracias. Thank you so much to the two moderators as well. Miguel, muchísimas gracias. We are approaching the end of the conference. We still have a couple of items we want to share with you. I just want to mention before we do a break for about 10 to 15 minutes that last minute, unexpected to us, we received a video, a salute, greetings from the executive director of the United Nations Environmental Program, Dr. Achim Steiner. Since we received his salute to the conference, unexpectedly we were not able to schedule the presentation. And honestly, I think we all have had and are having a very enriching but also very busy day of conference. I want to acknowledge that we received this salute, and as all other presentations here, all the lectures, the keynote addresses, etc., that video will be available to all of us through the webpage of the Global Food Security Institute. I want to remind you as well about that tool, because among many, many, many things that were shared here, there are certainly many of them get lost in our memory. So we have that instrument to continue sharing and refreshing our memories and discussion on the presentations today. So from this podium, thank you very much to Dr. Achim Steiner for thinking about us today and for his salute. will have a 10 to 15 minutes. I say 10 to 15 because I come to the podium before the 15 minutes are over. Break for you to stretch one more time before we move into the last section of the conference with the wrap-up comments, closing remarks, and we have a couple of people we wanna greet here on this podium, and also we will present the award for the poster competition from our graduate students. So I'll see you in 10 to 15 minutes back here.